The US has apparently supplied Ukraine with significant numbers of attackers of various types. Will these capabilities and other munitions supplied by the US, Germany, UK, and allies turn the tide of the war in favor of Ukraine after a period of uncertainty, dwindling supplies, losses, and anxiety? Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like, subscribe, and definitely add comments against the videos. It helps massively for people to find the incredible speakers who give up their time to appear on the channel. Also, please do check out the validated Ukrainian charities, which appear in the description of the video. It's never been more important than it is now to help Ukraine. Today, I'm talking for the second time. I'm delighted to talk to Jake Breaux, who is a United States Air Force veteran who served for 6 years as a nuclear missile operations officer. You may know him better, of course, as one of the most prominent voices on YouTube focusing on the conflict in Ukraine. Jake, it's fantastic to have you back.
Thanks for having me back, Jonathan. Good to see you again.
Well, a lot has happened. Of course, last time we spoke, we were in this ammunition famine, as it was called. And whereas that situation is now changing, it has had some very serious repercussions, hasn't it, in terms of Ukrainian loss of momentum, some loss, I think, of confidence, and of course, terrible losses of human life.
I think the last time we spoke was in January, and it wasn't that bad in January. But I mean, it visibly, you could feel it. I could feel it every day going into March and April. Thank God the United States Congress finally acted. But I mean, serious losses. I mean, obviously, the most important is the loss of life. Ukrainian soldiers can't be replaced. But then you can put a dollar value on the destruction of, for example, the Kyiv thermal power plants to rip everything out and replace it. It's going to cost close to like $1 billion or something absurd. If we had just passed this package 8 months ago, like we were supposed to, or even 6 months ago with a small delay, Ukraine still would have had the air defense systems to protect hospitals and schools and everything they've lost because, yeah, they were starved both of ammunition on the front lines, but also of air defense missiles that killed a lot of people when Russia can get through.
And now the aid package is starting to come through. It may take weeks, maybe even months because of logistical issues, but it is being delivered. But what next? I mean, is this enough to achieve Ukrainian victory? I think the general military consensus is that it's not. So what needs to happen now?
I do want to say, just because we passed this bill last month in the United States Congress, that doesn't mean we're good for a year. MAGA Republicans blocked it for 6 months. So basically $60 billion in aid is going to be condensed to be handed out over the next 6 months, half a year. We're not losing $30 billion just because people like Marjorie Taylor Greene were able to successfully block this. So I do think we have to get past the November election. No politician wants to talk about additional military aid prior to November 5th. That's fine. Ukraine will do fine. But come December or January, we need to have this conversation again about the next military aid package. And we have to stay true to our word as long as it takes. Russia cannot be rewarded by being allowed to keep any occupied territory, because the lesson that Vladimir Putin will learn is, well, if I just waste my military resources and allow my people to die, I eventually will expand my borders. I can redraw the map of the world. We're going to see how resilient Russia is come this winter. If you were paying attention last winter with all the utility failures, all the protests, we know once we get past the May 9th Victory Day parade, there's probably going to be another mobilization. Another 300,000 Russian men are going to be sent to the meat grinder just in time for Ukraine to roll out their new stockpiles of artillery on them. But we're going to have to reach a breaking point for Russia. It will inevitably come.
And of course, I mean, when we look at some of the narratives, especially some of the narratives that were doing the rounds in the MAGA GOP, and these narratives have been very effective at delaying the provision of munitions and getting this bill passed. We also see one of those narratives being that Europe is not pulling its weight. This is the continent of Europe. This is our backyard. That's been very successful. And we've, you know, we heard during the Trump administration He did, and maybe justifiably, make a point around that. What is the onus on Europe now to not just rely on the US, but to really ramp up the supply of munitions? Do you see any signs that that is happening as well?
First of all, everything that Donald Trump said was a lie. That's just what he does. Europe has been doing enough. You can't just look at military aid. The United States has been hoarding weapons for 70 years. So obviously we have more weapons to give. That should be the focus of the United States. But as far as humanitarian aid and economic aid, financial aid coming from the EU, European countries, the help and aid that Europe has given has far outweighed what the United States has done. I don't want to diminish what the United States is doing. We just have more weapons. The Europeans have more bread and butter. It all adds up. But Donald Trump is always going to lie about the numbers and complain about the numbers. The speculation this week is that he's not happy with the requirement of, it's a guideline, it's not even a requirement, 2% spending of your GDP on defense. Because the United States goes higher than that, he's going to move the goalpost. And if he gets elected in November, he's going to start criticizing European countries for not spending 3% of their GDP. It doesn't matter what Europe does. If I'm being honest with the MAGA base, it's popular to just trash Europe, trash Germany, trash France, trash the UK. For a lot of MAGA supporters, they don't have a passport. They never traveled to Europe. They don't care about Europe. So I think when Trump attacks Europeans or complains they're not doing enough, he's just trying to appeal to his base.
And that makes it remarkable to me. And I've had a couple of conversations about this with a number of people who are sort of quite close to the process. But it was something of a surprise when Speaker Johnson came out, made a speech. I mean, he's had a lot of fine words before, and then it hasn't been followed by action. This time he came out, made an impassioned speech, and got the aid passed. That was something of a surprise, I think, to a lot of people. What do you think changed behind the scenes? And even Trump seemed to, well, the assumption is he gave his tacit approval for that bill to pass, and his language was softened as well. So what on earth has happened?
There was a meeting between David Cameron and Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And this was like 2 days before Speaker Johnson visited Trump in Mar-a-Lago. And then the next week, Johnson flipped. I know the Polish president Duda also visited and met with Trump. So I think I want to believe that European leaders got on the phone and were willing to make that trip to Florida in person and spell it out for him what's on the line and what his next term, if he wins in November, will look like if he abandons Europe. If he just says, screw you, everyone in Europe, America is now a closed system. We've got the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. We don't care about anyone outside of it. This is insane because there's over a million Americans living or working in Europe right now. We have deep financial ties. The EU is our largest trading partner. I mean, I can give you basic facts about how important Europe is, but I don't think that swayed Trump. I think what Trump cares about is polling numbers. And supporting Russia is a losing issue here in America. When you look at polls for Americans, do you support additional military aid for Ukraine? It's consistently above 60%. So Trump flipped on Russia, support for this aid bill, to relieve the political pressure because he didn't want to talk about this prior to the November election. If the Russians spent the next 6 months continuing to blow up hospitals and power plants and dams and schools, every campaign event that Trump does, a reporter is going to ask him, what about Ukraine? So he just wanted it to go away. I don't think Donald Trump supports or cares about Ukraine. Mike Johnson is a puppet. He just does whatever Donald Trump tells him to do. So Trump wanted this issue to go away. Mike Johnson went to Florida to get permission to do this in person. The next day, Mike Johnson comes out and says, this is happening. It's not any more complicated than that.
That's extraordinary. I'd also heard that Johnson was introduced to I think it was a sort of Baptist minister, a Ukrainian.
That's a feel-good story, but I don't think Johnson cares about the lives of anyone outside of Israel. I mean, Israel seems to be the only country he cares about. But Christians in Asia, Christians in Africa, Christians in South America, Mike Johnson doesn't give a shit, just being honest. We can repeat that narrative that Baptist ministers got to him because Russia has destroyed hundreds of churches in the occupied. You would think that would sway a normal human being, but Mike Johnson is a political creature. I listening to that guy and seeing how easily he lies, I view him as soulless.
Yeah, and that narrative, you know, didn't work the previous 6 months, previous 8 months. So I think that's an interesting point there. If we turn to that, however, we see a number of things are changing, but a couple of things aren't. And I was at an event yesterday with a guy who was a senior national security advisor in Obama's, I was about to call it regime, administration. It was an elected administration. And he was going through, in a very honest fashion, actually, all the things they got wrong. And it was a really interesting discussion, you know, what they didn't understand about Russia, what they got wrong, how the ground was laid to enable and allow Russia to do what it's currently doing, and discussed sort of NATO as well. That's all well and good. But I suspect, and I'd love to hear your view, we still haven't quite learned the lessons of how Russia functions. We, despite the aid being delivered, despite the attack, and despite everything, we seem to be escalating in a proportional way, whereas Russia always seeks to out-escalate, always seems to do something outside of our frame of reference that we won't expect, be more brutal, you know, work through proxies. We've got gray zone warfare now. We've got the Middle East flaring up, and I suspect Russia has some kind of dotted line towards that, and various other conflagrations around the world, sub-Saharan Africa, etc. Are we still on this track where we escalate in a kind of rational, delayed manner, and Russia does what it does and is still outcompeting us in some ways?
Democracy is complicated and messy. Compromise is difficult. Unitary systems where one authoritarian makes all the decisions and everybody hops to it is just more efficient and faster. I think philosophically, prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, we didn't have a divide of democracy versus authoritarianism. The Western alliance was fine with authoritarians as long as they weren't communist. It was all about stopping the spread of communism. So when communism was defeated, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and there's all these dictatorships around the world, that's when it started getting uncomfortable, because what is the new divide now? And I can give you my favorite example, South Korea and North Korea. South Korea was a pro-Western dictatorship that the United States propped up and maintained until 1994. And the reason why, you know, South Korea today, you wouldn't think of this, you wouldn't imagine it, but the reason why is if you allow democracy in the age of communism, people might vote for communism. Kill all the rich people, take their stuff, redistribute it. You can get a majority support for that in an impoverished country. So the United States was suppressing democratic movements around the world, because if an authoritarian, if a communist can win an election fairly one time, that's the end of free and fair elections. But after communism was defeated, all these dictators around the world, and what do you do with them? We had to normalize relations. We had to accept this new world of, there's a dictator here, there's a dictator there. We have one rule. The United States has one rule. Stay in your own country. If you want to kill your own people, if you want to imprison your own people, whatever. Stay within your own borders. We'll buy your oil. We'll trade with you. You can even show up at the UN. Maybe we'll even have an occasional state event for you. And Russia broke that rule. Russia's not happy with it. Putin looks at the borders of the old Russian Empire and he wants to roll back the clock to 1918. That's madness.
Simple as that.
That's endless wars. So yeah, your question is, why isn't the West doing anything? Why aren't we taking this threat serious? And it's just because the last 30 years, or prior to the last 2 years, but since 1992, it's been a good deal. The pact that the Western Alliance has made with dictators around the world. We'll buy your oil. You can get rich. We'll look the other way when you kill your own people. But you just can't attack your neighbors. You can't invade other people. And Putin is not okay with that deal.
And this is the interesting point, isn't it, Jake? And this is the discussion I've been having. And I think it's still, you know, we've seen certain discussions being outside the envelope, and then they become normalized. I remember asking Ben Hodges in the first 6 months of the war whether Ukraine to win would have to take the war into Russian territory. And that question was so sort of shocking, I think, to most people at that point, and not really discussed. And people were like, no, they didn't even want to go there and consider it. Of course, now we're seeing the irregular Freedom Legions, or whatever they're called, the Russian legions fighting in Belgorod, Kursk, etc. And just this week, David Cameron has said, you can use Storm Shadow, whatever, to hit the territory of Russia. It's taken 2 years for what was considered absolutely outlandish to become acceptable. My thoughts is, well, what else should we be talking about now to enable a Ukrainian victory that is off the table at the moment, but in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months time will be normalized and will hopefully help towards Ukrainian triumph?
If this war, for some reason, God forbid, is still going on a year or two from now, let's just start blockading Russian ports. Nothing gets in or out. We're not going to sink anything. We're not going to kill anyone, but we will detain some ships if Russia tries to get stuff in and out. But I mean, that idea is outlandish today, just like you made the analogy of the UK allowing Storm Shadow cruise missiles to be used on the territory of Russia. Saying that that would happen 2 years ago, people would think we were nuts. So things are going to get worse before they get better. And yeah, there's a list of ideas I can come up with, technically, that are non-lethal to make life really painful for the Russians until they give up on their occupation.
I guess the number one thing we could properly enforce the blockade that's already supposed to be there, which is preventing sort of goods transitioning through Central Asia, preventing electronics and components from Russian missiles, machine tools. It's only at this point now, I think, that the US and certain European countries are just starting to look at some of those loopholes. It's been more than two years.
I'm going to toss this idea out there. I think Ukraine should be sinking empty tankers. Obviously, don't sink the tankers when they're sailing out and they're full of crude. We don't want to cause an ecological disaster. But if an empty tanker is going back to Russia to refill up in violation of all these sanctions, just sink the ship. Get a drone boat, figure out how to do it. We need to economically devastate the Russians. I understand what I just said is controversial, but this is all out war. Russia is going for genocide. Their goal is just to kill as many Ukrainians as possible, women and children, elderly, whoever. They don't care.
Similarly, if we look at the Ukrainian attacks on Russian energy infrastructure, I don't think you or I would find that in any way, you know, either surprising or unacceptable, given where we are. That was a fairly radical idea for some people, and it did seem, at least on the surface, that Jake Sullivan and the US administration were extremely uncomfortable with the idea of taking out Russia's oil refining capacity. That may well be extended to the actually the distribution of raw crude, the pipeline network, and ports. Would you support the extension, even the continuation and extension of Ukraine's tactic there?
I mean, I'll lay it out there, but militarily, I don't think Ukraine can win if Russia can keep regenerating their forces. You look at how many casualties Russia's taken a day. According to the Ukrainians, it's close to 1,000. How many new contract soldiers is Russia recruiting a day? It's about 1,000. Russia has figured out how to regenerate their losses, and they don't care about losses. So the only way to defeat Russia is a political or economic collapse inside of Russia. Everything that everyone in the world can do, death by 1,000 paper cuts, anything that hurts the Russian economy to any degree, it needs to be done to just hasten this. It's a mercy on Russia if we can cause them to politically or economically collapse sooner, before more of their sons and brothers and fathers die in this pointless war. There's only one person that needs to lose their head for all this killing to stop, and it's the guy at the top. It's Putin.
That's it. And even if someone else gets in who is fairly unsavory, they're going to be fairly distracted, aren't they, consolidating their regime within Russia. You know, going to have a period of a decade or so, at least, where a new dictator or a new strongman is going to have to reconsolidate their power.
It will be a new dictator to replace Putin, but the West will offer this guy the best deal in the world, the sweetest deal in the world. They will legitimize him, and they will recognize him as long as he just pulls out of the occupied territories and ends this war. It'll take time. There will be rounds of negotiations, but the West will embrace whoever this is that wants to be the new czar of Russia for life, as long as they go back to that one rule: you can't attack your neighbors and redraw the maps.
And of course, the oligarchs can get back to their villas, etc. I was listening to a Russian commentator, as he said, you know, we can't know for sure, but when you had the coronation of Putin, he was saying, look, there's at least double figures of the number of people, percentage of people in that audience at Putin's coronation who would love for him just to snuff it and for all this to end, so they could go back to where they were. I mean, that won't happen. We won't have a full return to how it was prior to full-scale war. But, what percentage do you think are extremists, are the absolute nutters who would like to continue this sort of war authoritarianism? And how
the
many?
The Russian oligarchs or the Russian general population?
Oligarchs and population.
True believers that think Russia deserves whatever they can take, yeah, it's probably about 30%. The other 60% are just going with the flow. And sometimes it's easier just to not resist. You know, when you see what your country and your leader and your military is doing, how do you sleep at night knowing that the Russian military every day is bombing churches and schools and hospitals deliberately? Human minds have to find a way to cope so that you can get that 6 to 8 hours of sleep at night or whatever. And there's a lot of evil things that people will accept just so they can get through the day, whatever motivates them, you know, family or community or whatever.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will be doing that. And when it's over, it's going to be very difficult for people to, if the truth does come out in Russia, and there is a debate, that's not only going to be painful, but there's going to be a lot of people who will want that to go away. You know, they won't want to pick that scab too much, unfortunately. But that's, I think, that's their problem. Another thing you mentioned earlier is Israel. Of course, we saw with the French, US, and UK response in shooting down the Iranian drones and other projectiles coming over Israel, we saw an immediate response using some, maybe not the, you know, the most high-tech equipment, but we saw a very high success rate and an immediate response at scale. And talking to a lot of Ukrainians, they're generous. You know, they understand this generosity of the West. They're grateful for it. But I think there's a certain amount of upset at the rapidity and scale of the Western response to protect Israel. And we haven't quite seen that same urgency to protect their hospitals, their schools, and their energy infrastructure, as we said.
I mean, I can give you a political answer in that the United States has a formal defense agreement with Israel, and they're honoring their defense agreement with Israel. The United States has no formal defense agreements with Ukraine. That agreement from 1994 had no it was a presidential executive order. Congress never signed or agreed to anything, so it has no permanent political weights in U.S. politics. That's the political answer. The true answer is there's a very large Jewish community here in the United States, and they care deeply about Israel. So for the two political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, they want to curry favor with the Jewish votes. They want their donor money and they want their connections. This is why Speaker Johnson talks about Israel every single day. Every single day, Speaker Johnson has to mention something related to Israel, because they want, yeah, they want that block of Jewish voters in the November election. They want their donor money and they want their political influence. Generally, I probably shouldn't generalize for an entire group of people, but I think when you actually do look at the polling numbers, more Jewish Americans vote for Democrats than for Republicans. More Jewish people are elected to Congress as Democrats than as Republicans. So this is a potential swing vote community here in the United States, and Donald Trump and Speaker Johnson are playing for them hard by who can be a bigger hawk on defense related to Israel.
Yeah, it's all about the transactional element of it. And I mean, fortunately, the aid package did pass. And I want to come back to, I think, the key point you made, which is about the one rule, not to break sovereign borders. And this is something which, at all the events I've been to, and more in the videos that I'm making, I'm asking the question that we need to look at what Russia's doing. It's not just exporting illegality in terms of its gray fleet, in terms of the authoritarian alliances it's making. My worry is that it's going to export this behavior of transgressing sovereign borders. At the moment, it is certainly through Wagner integrating itself into various African regimes in the Sahel, in sub-Saharan Africa. It's been implicated in a number of the many, many coups that have been taking place. And of course, you can see why they're doing it. You know, there's extractive industries there, gold, aluminium, even uranium, et cetera, which they can, or are, making a lot of money on. The real concern here is that they're going to, at some point, start exporting this change of borders as a way of integrating their power and kicking U.S. presence out of Central and even sort of West Africa and even other parts of the world. Is this something that's occupying your mind and something we should be focusing on?
The post-World War II era of politics is the exception to human history and civilization. When we figured out agriculture and we had food surpluses, we could raise large armies. This led us into the Age of Empires. So for 10,000 years of human history, we had empires that were constantly expanding or just dying. And we didn't have sovereign borders. The idea of sovereign borders didn't exist until after the 30 Years' War, the Treaty of Westphalia. This is like the late 1600s. We had the first modern states, and that's when the European powers were telling each other, hey, this 30 Years' War was really bad. Let's try and agree on borders. And then those are fixed borders. A couple more centuries of war and empire, the borders kept changing. But the goal was, let's stop changing borders, because a lot of people die when that happens. So in 1945, when the United States sat down all the allies at the Bretton Woods Agreement, they said, we're not doing this anymore. The age of empires, the age of saying, well, this territory belongs to me, and that guy also says that territory belongs to him. They're just going to fight about it occasionally. So this is like a new concept that you and I have lived with our entire lives, but for human history, this is brand new. The natural state of man, the natural state of authoritarians with supreme unchecked power and wealth in their own country, is to expand, to just attack their neighbors, kill them, and steal their stuff. So this is what Iran wants to do, China wants to do, Russia wants to do, North Korea wants to do, because it's just a repeating pattern that can't be broken. The United States tried to break this pattern. But if the United States Navy stops patrolling the world's oceans, if our 11 supercarrier groups retreat back to North America, I'm sorry, but the world is not going to be able to keep their shit together. And everyone is going to be attacking everyone to steal their stuff and redraw the maps. And Iran, China, and Russia are the biggest three offenders right now.
And it's a key topic, isn't it? I'm doing more videos as well with Ukrainians who, unsurprisingly, are the most vocal about this. And this is Russian imperialism and the mechanics and how it works and how it uses information, mythologized history, and all the other stuff. And I think it's important to kind of address this and look at it. But it's a difficult topic, isn't it? I suspect that many policymakers in the West simply do not have an idea of how to tackle Russian imperialism or any idea of what kind of Russia they want to see after it's defeated in Ukraine.
We don't care what Russia does inside of Russia with Russians, but they have to stay in their own country. That's the deal. I would love to have a peaceful and democratic, prosperous Russia where the vast wealth and resources of their country goes to benefit their people. But given Russian history and culture, they have no precedence to have a responsible and fair government that actually treats their own people well. It's really bleak, really dark, really depressing. And I think the best case scenario for the Russian people is if they just break up. It's 140 million people, break it up into 14 Belarus-sized countries, have smaller local representation, more responsive to the people in the area. Yes, there's going to be winners and losers. There's going to be rich states and poor states, but we have to stop this pattern, this repeating pattern of the concentration of wealth and power in Moscow that always leads to millions of people dying.
And of course, Russia has been very effective at raising those local identities. But there are some countries, and it's not necessarily happening internally, but the countries that did form part of the colonial entity that broke up when the USSR broke up, Georgia, Armenia, for instance, they are, or at least Armenia is pulling outside of Russia's orbit, is moving more towards the West. And Georgia, who has a, I would say, Russia-friendly government, that's at serious risk of a new Maidan process. So do you think the periphery, the former colonial entities, will break free of Russia's influence before the internal territories within Russia?
If Russia's military is broken, then yeah, these people want to be sovereign and independent and free. I don't see why anyone in Kazakhstan cares at all about Russia, aside from their economic and trade relations. But Russia, Putin, wants to get the band back together. You know, his goal is to just eventually reabsorb everything, get back to the 1918 borders or the 1991 borders. But it's never going to end. When you look at the Iron Curtain and what Europe, how Europe was divided, even if Putin doesn't outright invade and annex territory, he's never going to stop undermining the democracies in Bulgaria, Romania, Poland. The goal is to fund and back right-wing fascist politicians that can get that 51%, because you know a fascist dictator has to legitimately win the first time. And then as soon as you're in the office, crack down on free media, destroy the courts, subvert the legislature, and then never leave office. Just pull a Lukashenko, a Viktor Orban, just never leave office. But you're a pro-Russian government, and Putin will give you money, he'll give you weapons. All you have to do is not be a democracy.
An oligarchy is, there are a number of mechanisms for Russia to exert its control, but oligarchs are a critical one. I think we were discussing this in an interview with a Georgian. There's a unique circumstance in Georgia where, unlike Ukraine, which had multiple oligarchs, many of them competing with each other, Georgia pretty much has one. And his wealth amounts to around 30% of the GDP of the entire country. So it's a fairly crazy state of affairs. I couldn't quite believe that figure, but I got it confirmed by a number of people. Russia will utilize that ruthlessly, won't it? But We should learn this, because I suspect they're also utilizing the concept of oligarchy, and our own systems slide towards more oligarchic control and interest. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, big donors, et cetera. How do we make our systems more resilient now that we have a much clearer idea of the kind of tools of influence and coercion that Russia uses?
I forget who mentioned this. It might have been Jane Keeve on Twitter, but he said every Western military in the world needs to have a dedicated branch or a dedicated unit to fighting disinformation from authoritarian regimes. This needs to be tracked, it needs to be identified, and we have to work with companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft or whoever to stop this. Because it's not free speech. It's not free speech when somebody can pay money to have tens of thousands of bots spamming propaganda and a blatant lie. If Elon Musk wants to die on that sword and say that should be protected, when it's killing us, like it's killing our democracies, and we need to have serious conversations, because that's not free speech, and we have to put a stop to this. I mean, I can give you examples, but it's obviously, you can, if you have enough money and you know how, you can brute force people into believing things that are obviously not true.
And I think it's interesting. I mean, watching your channel, watching a number of channels that have appeared, Vlad Vexler and others, and realizing that, okay, we reach a certain number of people. We're not necessarily going to change everyone's opinion or reach everyone. But it is having effect. How do you think what we're doing can help to turn the tide of propagandistic BS?
What's that Mark Twain quote? A lie can get halfway around the world before the truth can even get his shoes on. So it's hard. You know, I shouldn't be the guy. When I reflect on my own YouTube path, my own YouTube career, I even ask myself, like, I have imposter syndrome. Like, why is it me doing this? I should be talking about credit card bonuses and trading options, which is what I was talking about prior to the war. But so many people have told me in the comment section and through messages that I'm just a genuine, authentic, real person. And yeah, Chinese bot farms, Russian bot farms, they can spam 10,000 comments a day per account all over social media, but those aren't real people. You don't see their face. You don't know their human story. So when people tune into you, or they tune into me, or they tune into Dennis or Arthur or whoever, these are real people with real histories, real names, and you can build a human connection with them, which is something that Russian bot farms can't do. And if we want to be honest, the people who support Russia are all serious creeps and losers. Scott Ritter is everywhere all the time, and the guy's a convicted child sex offender. Like Steven Seagal, he looked pretty bad at Putin's inauguration. I saw the pictures and videos. So the human beings that Russia trots out to defend them, I don't know how people connect with those people, but they have their audience, I guess.
Well, Packer did a fantastic episode of Vatnik Soup on Steven Seagal and his sort of background in Hollywood. Not apparently a really popular man, you know, even when he was not backing Putin and resurgent autocracy. I get the impression, though, I mean, going through the comments, I don't. I have to check myself, because when I first set up the channel, I'd reply angrily, a bit of a keyboard warrior on the old comments. I'd get sort of personally affronted by some of them. And I've sort of learned to kind of calm down and think reflectively. And you see patterns of language that actually occasionally you will get people who are repeating Russian narratives, but who I feel are genuinely reaching out and not just trying to sort of spam the comment section. And those ones I do try to engage with, what's the sort of pattern you see on your channel? Because, of course, you got a huge audience. You have a lot of bots.
The success rate of trying to convince somebody who has fallen victim to Russian propaganda is very low. the fact that in a comment section, like if I were to be able to sit down with them in a coffee shop for an hour, I think I could convince them on a one-to-one basis. But in the comment section, if I wasted my time replying to them, trying to reach them, it's not going to happen. And I hate this, but the answer is just to be relentless and louder with my narrative to exhaust them. Because I do think this has happened. I think in the last 2 years in the comment section, there were lots of people who were pro-Russian. But I think they're tired. Like, I think they're sick of it. When you look at how far the Russians had advanced in the Avdiivka direction in 2 years, 2 years of fighting, hundreds of thousands of dead, and they've advanced 22 kilometers.
It is extraordinary, isn't it?
for idiots who support Russia, you know, every time they take one of these small villages like Ocherentny or whatever, and they, you know, it's like the fall of Berlin again. And I'm like, you guys are losers. Losers. If you're cheering on the capture of this village with a pre-war population of 500 people, I belittle them. I disparage them. I want them to feel like clowns and idiots for following Russian disinformation and falling victim to this. And they don't have to flip. They don't have to become pro-Ukrainian, but they do need to shut the hell up. And they need to stop harassing people and pushing this narrative. So if they just go away and be quiet, I'll accept that. But yeah, I just have to be relentless with my narrative, with my facts, my truth, my evidence, my maps. And I've never wavered. Russia is going to lose this war.
And this is a fascinating question about winning, because of course a lot of the troll comments, a lot of the people who are actually bought into Russian narratives, but who are trying to be genuine, all of them eventually pivot on this idea that Russia has gained something somehow in the sum total of its aggressive war. It's gained something. When you look at it, though, I mean, they've trashed their economy. They've lost hundreds of thousands of people physically on the battlefield. Millions of people have fled the country, some of their most talented and educated people. And the remaining population have lost whatever semblance of agency or expression they might have had. Everyone's just sort of keeping their head down, not saying anything. I think every Russian knows they live in an autocracy. Every Russian knows that their free speech, as such as it existed, has disappeared. The sum total of loss is huge, isn't it? I mean, Russia has trashed its soft power, trashed its economy, and essentially it's busy trashing whatever it remains of its reputation.
Russia has no future. Demographically, they have no future. Young people, ethnic Russians, I mean, there's a high birth rate amongst minorities and people from the Caucasus, immigrants, Muslims. But as far as the Orthodox ethnic Russians, they're not having kids and they're dying off. And, you know, their culture of, if toxic masculinity could manifest itself as a sovereign state, it would be Russia. And I don't think Russian women appreciate it. You know, their husbands beat them or they're abusive alcoholics. Like, why are you going to have six kids? I understand. 100 years ago, that's just what women accepted and did. But in the modern information age, when women can see how other women in other parts of the world are living, no, they're just protesting with their wombs, basically. And ethnic Russians are going to die out as a response unless they change their society and they become a more free and fair place. But Putin's running the gambit, and he's going to see if they can pull this off. You know, they've got their cheerleaders in the West who love Russian culture. Love it. You know, if you want to murder someone from the LGBT community, go ahead. You know, I think that is the draw for a lot of really nasty people living in the West. Is it okay to be cruel to immigrants, to be cruel to Muslims, to be cruel to the LGBT people? That's a sick narrative that I don't talk about in my videos as much, but I think it's there, and it's pretty bleak. And maybe we could talk about the economics, but Russia has no future.
No, I mean, this is one I'm going to tackle with Konstantin in the next one of our chats, because it's interesting talking to people, you know, behind the scenes who have connections still with the business community in Russia. And we see the headline stuff around hitting the energy refineries, etc. What we don't see is stuff going on behind the scenes, the hike in taxes, the stealth theft of profits from businesses that are still making money. And then what we're also seeing, I mean, if you're familiar with the story of Bill Browder and how much his capital was stolen by bureaucrats. Well, yeah. That's now happening to thousands of businesses where Zed patriots, loyalists, scumbags will pay an apparatchik to have them steal the business of somebody else. And then, you know, that business owner will be kicked out or incarcerated or, goodness, even sent to the front. You're seeing that same pattern of theft and illegality being repeated 1,000 times over. So that collapse of Russia is hastening, perhaps more than many experts appreciate.
It's a smash and grab right now. Anybody with the force and the lack of a moral conscience can, yeah, do whatever they want now, as long as they're loyal to Putin. As long as you stay loyal to Putin, cannibalism is okay. Literally, they have cannibals being released from prison and sent to the front lines in Ukraine.
I might have to bleep that out because use of that word got my last video demonetized there.
Really? Wow.
It was either it's either the M word or the, you know, but something kind of went badly wrong with that one.
And go ahead.
Yeah. But it's a fascinating story, and it is terrifying, as you say. This is a gangster in Siberia who cooked and ate the heart of his victim.
Right now, Russia's economy on paper is still technically growing because there's so much stimulus occurring. The fact that Putin saved up this $600 billion wealth funds, he still had $300 billion to play with at the start of the war. He's making it rain on these small impoverished towns, a $2,000 a month salary for contract soldiers. This is a huge stimulus for rural Russia, small town Russia. So people are still doing business because the money's still there. But what happens when Putin's wealth fund is exhausted? They're already running monthly deficits. As soon as the money's not there, companies that should have left Russia 2 years ago will finally leave Russia.
And their assets will be stolen.
Yeah, but I mean, that's at the end of the day, Russia is using the foundations of capitalism against us. The goal of a capitalist is to maximize profits regardless of the humanitarian or environmental costs. The only reason why you would factor in humanitarian or environmental costs is bad PR. That could hurt your business if people are upset you're polluting a river. But in general, I mean, if your goal is to maximize profits, you don't care if people are suffering or dying. So the people still doing, Western companies still doing business in Russia, they don't care how many people Russia kills. But when the money runs out, there's going to be this downward spiral, this avalanche effect where, yeah, they get out of there because they're not profitable anymore. And it's a compounding effect that is going to crush Russia really abruptly.
And I've only got a couple of questions sort of left, but I think what you've just said there leads naturally onto a topic which we've been covering a lot on the channel recently. And this is taking those frozen assets and giving them to Ukraine to hasten the Ukrainian victory. I'm assuming you're for that measure. How can we normalize that? How can we make that more popular and acceptable? Because those who go against it have, in my view, a lot of strong but spurious arguments. What should we do?
The banks are against it. The banks don't want the assets of a country or oligarchs or whatever being seized and given to victims of war crimes. Because then authoritarians around the world won't want to keep their money in Western banks. So the banks have been fighting this. They say, you can't do this. This would cause an economic calamity in your country, France. your country, Germany, your country, the United States, if you start seizing dictatorship money, then other dictatorships will basically trigger a run on the bank. You know, when you abruptly pull out tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars, given the nature of the fractional reserve system, it's your assets, it's my assets, it's the everyday American or Brit who will be caught up in these banks contracting, run on the banks. I mean, the last bank failure we had in the United States was 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, Silicon Valley Bank. Everyone was panicking. Everyone was freaking out about Silicon Valley Bank going under. And nothing came of it. Everything stabilized. But take that event and magnify it by 10. That's what could happen. And this is what the banks are telling politicians. This is why politicians are freaked out about it. What the G7 is doing as a compromise is saying, okay, this $300 billion, we're going to take the interest that's been accumulating from these assets in the bank. We're not going to take the original assets to, you know, not cause a panic. But we're going to take the interest and we're going to use that to help Ukraine.
It's not happened yet, but I know a lot of people who are actively pushing for that. The delays as well in getting Ukraine what it needs and the sort of escalation management hesitancy on our side does seem to have in some ways strengthened Russia on one front, and that is the brutality that they are prepared to inflict. And in particular, I wanted to mention the glide bombs, which are a particularly sort of vindictive innovation by Russia. Very much reminds people, certainly in the UK, of the German V1 weapons. You know, you launch it and off it goes. There's no precision there, but it's nasty psychologically, and it could do quite a bit of damage wherever it hits. You can't really control where it hits. Just point it to the largest city. Where do you see this going? Because Russia has potentially thousands, if not tens of thousands, of these ancient bombs they can strap wings to. Is this going to turn in some ways the tide of war towards Russia, or is it simply going to cause more trauma, damage, and criminality?
Ukraine has to shoot down these planes. I mean, the glide bombs will never stop, but if we can get more Patriot launchers to Ukraine and they can be on the front lines moving around, this was happening back in January and February. Ukraine, on average, was shooting down a Russian jet every other day, and then they had to stop because they ran out of interceptor missiles. But as soon as the Patriot launchers protecting cities are all reloaded, they're going to put this Patriot back on the front lines, and they're going to go after these planes. F-16s are also going to have to, AMRAMs, air-to-air missiles, they're going to have to go after these jets as well. Because, yeah, I mean, Russia's supply of dumb bombs with cheap glide kits is endless, and they're relying heavily on it now. I think the number was over 3,000 of these glide bombs were fired on Ukraine just in the month of April.
Huge numbers.
You got to get the jets.
Yeah. So they can't be launched from the territory of Russia to hit targets. They have to be launched from a jet within the territory of Ukraine. Is that right?
Well, they're glide bombs, so they're gliding. I mean, I don't know what the distance or range is, but yeah, you got to be within 80 or 90 kilometers when you release them.
The last question, really, and this is the one which I don't ask historians or military analysts because they squirm. Are you confident of Ukrainian victory? Do you think we will rally around and give Ukraine what it needs to actually achieve what I think we all accept, which is that victory is essential in securing not peace, but security for the state of Ukraine?
There's no scenario in which Russia wins this long term. People say that time is on Russia's side, and I disagree. I think time is against Russia, as everything domestically in their country weakens every day. The modern state of Ukraine, I hate to say this, but things can always get worse. And if, you know, Ukrainians turn into insurgents, if they don't even have an organized military anymore, these attacks will never stop. The drain, the bleeding of Russian forces in the occupied territories will never stop. It's their land. It's their people. Russia has declared genocide on them. What can be a more motivating factor to go literally to the last Ukrainian. This is a Russian propaganda narrative that the United States is behind this. The United States is pushing Ukraine to kill all their people. No, if the United States stopped supporting Ukraine, if the United States walked away, Ukraine would still do it. And I would 100% understand why they'd do it. So I'm really thankful for the Ukrainian people, honestly, because I think there was this malaise and this lackadaisical attitude from the West about our democracies and our militaries and our relationships with authoritarian regimes like China and Russia. Russia's ruined all of this. Everything is being reevaluated right now. And the biggest loser with relations with the West is China. China has to be infuriated, as they had their own plans, maybe for Taiwan in the future, but the industrial base of the United States is being rebuilt. Manufacturing lines that went cold decades ago for like Stinger missiles are now being fired back up again. Europe is buying weapons like crazy. All of this could find its way to the Pacific Rim if China wants to try something in the future. So China's the big loser here, but
and of course, it's Belt and Road Initiative. I mean, for those who say Russia is delighted at that China's delighted at what Russia's doing and that Russia's simply a Chinese proxy, I think you're right there. It actually upends a lot of China's long-term plans. I mean, the Belt and Road Initiative is not going to work if parts of Russia fragment because there are key territories it actually runs through. So that's incredibly important to know. But I think we've reached the end for today, Jake. And I wanted to, as we did last time, say thank you to everything you do. You appear on a lot of the pro-Ukrainian channels. You're extremely supportive of individual creators who are fighting the corner for Ukraine and fighting for democracy and values. Tremendous what you're doing. And I think my audience will be incredibly grateful that you're back on the show as well.
And thank you, Jonathan, for all the time and effort you put in the last 2 years. I know you're coming up on 100,000 subscribers. So if anyone has made it this far and not subscribed, we got to get Jonathan that silver play button. It's a good feeling when you finally get there as a YouTuber. But thank you for everything you've been doing as well.